Welcome to Recipe for Peace Now. I'm your host, Sue Beller, and this is the show where we find practical, real-life solutions to difficulties bringing people together for a common goal, a common good. We will discuss listener emails, answer common questions, and at the end of the show, we will have two delicious potluck recipes made for sharing with your new community of, well, if not exactly friends, at least willing participants. If you would like to send us an email or favorite recipe, please email us at recipeforpeacenow@gmail.com or visit our website, www.recipeforpeacenow.com. Also, if you would like to hear prior shows, they are archived on that website, recipeforpeacenow.com. Thanks. Now let's get started. This time, we're going to be talking about using research. Now, we talk about research and about making subcommittees and teams in order to find something out, but let's talk about today what it is, what type of research that we need within our context, within the context of a workshop or a seminar or a mediation or an alternative dispute resolution. What kind of research do we need to bring? What kind of research do we need to do? What kind of research do we need to have so that we can get to our successful outcome, which is, of course, the bottom line. Oh, my, I see there's lots of people. Thank you very much for all of your participation. And, yes, you know, I think this is a rather big topic because I can see there's lots of ideas about types of research that we need. So let's divide it up into categories and then talk about each category as we get there because we have lots of people saying basically the same thing. Let's see. I think the first type of category of research that we use is statistics. Yeah, statistics, actual numbers. And then I'm going to call this factual. It's information about laws, et cetera. That's not exactly it's a little different than the statistics facts. So statistics, factual. I'm going to call the next group history, because people are talking about we research what other people have done. So that's history, the prior attempts, and the prior attempts to resolve the issues. Yeah, that's history. I'm going to call the next one, and I'm writing these down as I go so that we can actually talk about them. Right. Information on other groups. Yeah, that's different than history. We're looking at groups that are there now and what they're doing. Information on other groups that are similar to us. Ah, that's a good point. Now that I said that, people are saying, how about information on the opposition? Yeah, the groups that are not in favor of resolving the issues in the way that we would like. Right? Yeah, that's interesting, too. That's another group that's not with us. That's an interesting research. Uh-huh. Yeah, I'm going to say additional information for decisions, sort of extra stuff that you didn't know existed. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, we're going to do identification of experts because that's how we're going to find something out. We're going to research who does know something that, well, we'd like that we maybe not have thought of. Yeah. We're going to research some experts, right? Yeah. So, there's quite a few categories. Let's get started, right? Yeah. So we said statistics was the first one. It may be the most, I don't know if it's the most straightforward or not, come to think of it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it seems like facts. Factual is our second one, the facts, the factual information. But statistics, you need to look at the underlying information, right? If they look straightforward, statistics look like facts, right? Yeah, facts. Yeah. Some of you are saying, and this is, I don't know if this is true or not, but probably probably in the back of my mind. It may be my preconceived notion, right? Quite a few people are saying that facts and statistics are always manipulated and there's no such thing as a straight statistic or fact. Yeah, I think we're going to come to that conclusion. You just have to be careful, right? Because with statistics, you have to look at the underlying presumption, the underlying information. Now, some of you, so there's quite a few people also saying that I'm going to break out my favorite statistic story. It's true. And thank you all for listening so carefully over the years, because I don't break it out that much, but I do have a favorite statistic story. This is an absolutely true statistic. 50% of the women in my graduating class, when I got the LLM in taxation, it's a secondary extra law degree. It makes me a tax and business lawyer. It's after the Juris Doctor, so it was not such a big class. 50% of the women in my graduating class, when I got the LLM, married a law professor. Now, y'all sitting back, those of you who haven't heard this story before, and going, wow, 50% is a lot. And it's a true statistic. But there's an underlying fact about the numbers that you need to look into, right? Yes, some of you have got it. Maybe you've heard the story before, but yes. The question is, how many women were in your graduating class when you got the LLM? Because 50% of them married a law professor. And the answer is, the underlying fact is two. There were two of us, and I didn't marry a law professor. Yeah. Is it still a true statistic? You betcha. One out of two is 50%, right? My friend, who was the other woman who graduated with me, married the law professor. But see, is that a useful statistic now? Because it's very big, and it would be factored into other numbers. Well, I don't know if it's useful to you or not, but you sure want to know the underlying fact, right? The underlying number. Yes, the pool, how many people participated in the survey, in the study that led to the statistic. Yeah. So how many people? Mm-hmm. Yes. So how do we acquire the underlying information is the key to statistics. We've got to look into it. And if it's not possible to look into it, then maybe we should look further, right? Yeah. Kristen, others are saying you need the study assumptions, the underlying assumptions, the underlying figures, right? Yeah. And Hussein says you need the number of participants. That should be told. If you are looking at statistics of some sort, you should ask where they came from, right? Look into where they came from. And there should be facts about how the numbers were achieved. I know, people are saying they're in the teeny-weeny fine print. This is true. But if it's valid and it was done in any kind of a reasonable, logical, scientifical type manner, there should be, like the study assumptions, as Krista says, the number of participants. Madison and others are talking about how the participants were chosen. That makes a real big difference to the numbers, doesn't it? If you have handpicked your participants, well, you've skewed it, right? You've changed the result by making certain that all the people would be a certain way. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so those statistics are skewed. Now, it doesn't make them wrong, but you got to know that. You got to acknowledge it. Yeah. Drew and others are also talking about who funded the statistics, who funded the study, the survey, whatever it is that statistics have gotten from. Who funded it? Where'd the money come from? Because that may show a bias. It may show that the numbers were accumulated with an intent in mind, right? Yeah. So that shows bias. How do the numbers were chosen? Who funded it? Pramala says also the purpose of the study. That kind of goes to who funded, but it goes hand in hand. The purpose of the study. Was it done by a certain organization? Done by somebody who was trying to get a grant from someone. So they wanted to show that their numbers added up, that they were the ones that could produce. All these things make a difference. Now, does it mean the statistics are bad? No, not really. Does it mean that they are false? No, not really. But yes, people are saying it doesn't mean either of those things, but it means that they are biased. I think, basically speaking, that all statistics, well, people are saying something like the census isn't biased, I suppose. But many, okay, we'll say many, right? Well, because all is too big a word. But many statistics have an underlying bias because they wanted to show something, right? And that's why when you do research and you use the internet especially, if organizations have been putting out statistics, they look wildly different sometimes. The number of people that are having a cure of some sort, for example. Well, it depends where you're taking your patient group from. It depends what you consider to be a cure, right? It depends how long. You know what I mean? It's all dependent on your base, on your underlying assumptions, on who funded the project, on the purpose of it, on the number of participants and how they were chosen. You see, it's not that you can't use the statistics and that they're not interesting, but that's a research that you need to research further and not just take on face value, right? Right. Now, our next topic, I think, is factual research. And as James puts it, and others too, there's an underlying question of whether it's fact or opinion. Yeah. Whether it's fact or opinion. A lot of things that masquerade as facts are really opinions, aren't they? This is a good point, too. Tamika and others are saying not only whether it's fact or opinion, but that generally accepted truth may be called into question by the issues. Sometimes that's what we're talking about, is a generally accepted truth. We can all think of something that we really kind of know is true. But it's being called into question. And over history, of course, there have been lots of generally accepted truths that were accepted as facts and weren't actually facts at all. How about the world is flat? The earth is flat. Or that the sun travels around the earth, or any of that kind of stuff. That was a generally accepted fact until it was proven not to be true. Yeah, because sometimes that's what we're doing. Sometimes that's what the issues are all about, right? It's about the fact that that's not a fact, that that's not a truth forever and in the future, right? Yeah. And especially with advances in technology and advances in science, a lot of stuff that was a fact, that was a generally accepted truth, isn't true. And you can all think of one. I know one that is going to be very weird to a lot of you. When I was a little kid, really a little kid, everyone I knew, my family and like that, and it must have been like advertised as such beforehand, thought that if you had a cold, a sore throat and a cold, you know, you were feeling under the weather, that a menthol cigarette would help that. Yeah, not so sure no more. Yeah, facts kind of, truths and facts have to be thought about, right? Yeah. Kind Hillard and others are saying that if you have a generally accepted truth, it's a preconceived notion. Mm-hmm. Maybe, yeah. It's something that you come in knowing, and then you have to think about whether or not that's fact or truth or not, and we got to look into it, yeah. Mm-hmm. And remember that facts have a position also, so that people that tell you something as fact might have an underlying purpose or preconceived notion. Yeah. You know, there's an entire... This is true. Some of you were watching it too. Isn't that funny? And I don't know about... This is, of course, a global show. And so I don't know about other places. But in the United States, there's like... There's like... I'm going to call it science fiction. But there are a lot of television channels, right, and cable and stuff. And some of them go for the more unusual theories. Mm-hmm. Now, scientific, you can argue. My purpose is not to argue it. But there's some programs, some series where people talk about stuff. And they promote a less-than-mainstream viewpoint. And one of them is, and it's being used as an example by a lot of you, so I think it's kind of funny because I've seen it too. One of them is the theory that the ancient people all over the world, what they thought was God, were really astronauts. They were travelers from other planets who came down, who hung out on Earth and taught humans things. Right? Right. Now, that's stated as a fact. These people seem very good. They seem very rational. They get on television. They've written books. They've done seminars. They've talked in colleges. They've got credentials, is what I'm telling you. And they seem reasonable and perfectly sane. I have an opinion about whether that's a fact, but they're stating it as fact and not as opinion. And they've all got all kinds of facts that they've researched and a lot of people that agree with them to back up their claim, right, of ancient astronauts. Okay, cool. But you got to understand that they come from a certain viewpoint with a preconceived notion that what some of us refer to as God was really an extraterrestrial, and everything kind of went downhill from there, or uphill, according to them, because you learn science and things. But anyway, and they're reasonable, they're lecturers, and they're experts in the God is an astronaut field. But you got to understand that that's their field. That's where their business is. That's where their livelihood is. That's where they make their claim to fame, right? Yeah. And they argue quite convincingly. And they're not, you know how sometimes people, you can see that whatever they think is kind of, well, they're not real stable humans. No, they look just fine. And a lot of them have wonderful credentials. So, hey, they're college professors and things, yeah. But you got to look to the source of your facts, right? Mm-hmm. No, they don't think those are opinions. They think they're actual facts. So there. Yeah. Evelyn and others are saying that whenever you're dealing with any kind of facts like that, you have to think about them. And a lot of people are using the word think outside the box because you have to think about whether your established truths, your facts, are really preconceived notions. They're being told to you as a fact. And they may be believed as a fact, but there's several sides to it. Because facts are not necessarily so straightforward. Yeah. Let's see. Michael and others are saying that you need critical research of what is deemed to be accepted fact and reach consensus on whether to accept. Yes, that's what we do. We take the research to the group. We look at it all critically. Where'd it come from? What's its viewpoint? Is it promoting some sort of a viewpoint? We reach consensus, whether it's useful or not, and in what way. And we reach consensus on whether to accept it as a fact. Mm-hmm. And whether to look at lots of things. I'm with Nahoko, who says, you collect all the facts, which she puts in quotation marks, and sort them into the truth within the group. Yeah, that's what you do. You look at everything. I like to look at everything. I like everything to be put on the table. Then we look at it, we sort it through, and we reach the fact for our group for consensus, right? Yeah. It's kind of like a negotiation. But we look at everything and we go, you know, this is what this person says, this is what that person says. They're all saying it's a fact. Let's look at it and see where they've come from, what their bias is, why they've promoted this as a fact. And let's look at it all and find our own, what facts we're going to use, what we're going to be as our baseline, right? But we've got to look at all of it. So our next topic is history, right? What happened in the past? What did people do? What's already been done, right? Alex and others are saying that you look to what has been done in the past successfully. Yeah. And then Linda and others are adding to it, and you know this is, of course, my bias. She says that you look to failures as learning examples. I like to look at both. I like to look at successes. They're wonderful examples. And I know experts is our last one of our list, but they're wonderful places to get experts, right? Somebody did it right. They managed to do whatever it was that was needed to be done. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So look to the past that was successful, history, and see if we can emulate it, and see how it applies to us now. Because sometimes things change. You know, it's never exactly the situation, primarily because we're dealing with different humans, and different humans are never exactly the same situation. But it could be very similar, right? Yeah. And you look to the past, well, not such successes. So we call them failures. Mm-hmm. And they are learning examples, right? They show us, well, then maybe we shouldn't duplicate that. It's been done, and why didn't it work? Because sometimes the reason something failed was not because the idea was bad, not because the concept was bad, but because something in the execution of it, something about that group dynamic, something maybe even about the leader, because it certainly wasn't us, caused it to not come to fruition, right? It failed not because it was a bad idea, but something happened. Sometimes the something that happened is outside the group's ability to help. Something changed. It just wasn't, somehow it wasn't the right time. It was too early. Right? And now societal opinions have changed. Yes, I'm going to use my marijuana example again. I am. Because for years, after marijuana became illegal, there were groups that pushed for legalization of medical marijuana in the United States. For a while there, it was too early. It was the country was very conservative about that. Yeah. We can use prohibition. Everybody knows what prohibition was. This is it's an American thing, and this is, of course, a global show. There was a time in United States history when there was such a strong movement against alcohol, the drinking of alcohol, that alcohol was made illegal. Now, it was like the law of unintended consequences, right? It seems okay, but it made for an entire underground of drinking because people didn't want to give up their alcohol. Yeah, it was a really dumb idea. It seemed okay, and there was obviously a big push for it. And it got voted in. They changed the Constitution. I mean, it was a biggie. And then it had to be repealed. An equal biggie, because they had gangsters. I mean, all of you have seen those gangster movies, no matter where you are. Al Capone, yeah, the whole bit, the whole nine yards. And it was lasted for a while because laws move slowly, but see, times changed. And there was the law of unintended consequences. Things got worse after they banned alcohol, right? Yeah. So it was a biggie, and it was put in because of a great deal of citizen movement, and then it had to be repealed for the same reasons, because law enforcement couldn't handle it is really the reason. Yeah. So anyway, so you have to look and see how history is within its time frame, too. Yeah. And look to failures. Is that a failure? Yeah, it's a success and a failure simultaneously. And you have to look and see why things happen, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is an interesting point. Richard and others are saying you also have to look to who reported the history. Who reported the history? Nicole says look at all sides. It is a fact, really is a fact, too, that, least speaking, you need to look to who reported it, because the victors, the ones who win, usually write the history more so than the ones that didn't win. And that makes for a skewed reporting. Now, that was even more true before the internet. The internet is a wonderful thing, because you used to have to report in books, right? And in books and in articles and things like that, and they were stagnant. And only people who had, oh, some influence and some power and some money and like that got to write stuff that was put down in history, because the other people had no access to being heard by the general public. This is a true statement. But nowadays, everybody gets heard. Is that a good thing? Yes. Is it a bad thing? Yes. Primarily because it means that everybody gets heard. So you have to think about whether or not who the person is. And you know, anonymous is not a real fine thing a lot of times. You got to think about it as a group, right? Yeah. So you looked at who reported the history. Yeah. Anwar says that the past informs the present, which is really true. It's kind of an expression, but if you think about it, it's probably in every language. The past informs the present. You look at it, and you look at it as a way to think about what should be done now, and not just as a trivia anecdote. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's move on to our other topic, or else we not only won't make the recipes, we won't make our time. So the next one is the research of other interested groups. And that's a very good one. Mm-hmm. George and others are saying you determine if you want to join forces. Do you ever read the expression, there's strength in numbers, right? You pool, P-O-O-L, your resources. You pool your talent. You pool your expertise, right? Yeah. You might want to reach out to other interested groups who are working on the same issues and see if you can work together, see if you can get ideas together. We do this a lot. I do it a lot. Especially, you know, the United States is a very large, physically a large country, and we're divided into states. And state laws and things are different. They're similar but different across state lines. And sometimes you've got an issue that affects the country state by state because you want to change the state laws, which will cause the whole country to go. And also, if more states do something, then the federal government, which is slow to react and kind of set in its ways, will think about things. You might even bring something into the court system. There are levels of law, levels of court in the United States. And if something becomes a real serious issue, a social issue, a legal issue, it is hopeful and possible. It takes a little while because it has to become important enough. because they only take so many cases a year. You might even want to bring something to the Supreme Court of the United States. You have to work your way through the court system, right? You have to work your way up. But in order to do that, a lot of interested parties actually help. It is, first of all, expensive, time-consuming, and it needs to be done really intelligently with a lot of people helping and experts and things. And so a lot of times when something needs to be looked at by the courts and you want it to go and have law that applies to all the states, which is what the Supreme Court is, people ask if it's a federal court. It's kind of the last court in a line of going upward, and the Supreme Court rulings, their judgments, are law for all the states. And the United States Congress and stuff has to listen to them. So, yeah, it really is a federal court, and it's the highest one. And as you can see, excuse me, my voice is going. As you can see, let me take a sip of water. I got so excited by the thought of Supreme Court. Hang on. Oh, excuse me. It's a big deal to get there. And so you might join with other groups in order to reach the Supreme Court, in order to reach politicians, in order to reach more people, more public opinion. Mm-hmm. And quite frankly, your opposition does the same because there's two sides when you get to court, right? Right. Because if there was only one side, they wouldn't have anything to judge. Mm-hmm. Yeah. At the moment, the issue of gay marriage between two people of the same sex, is they're trying to get it to go to the Supreme Court to make law, so that each state doesn't have to decide, and so the Supreme Court can give guidance about the law. Anyway, and it is indeed more than just a social issue. It has a lot of different sides to it, one of them being a business and monetary issue because of spousal benefits. And that's actually something that most people don't think about. They see the social reasons or the religious reasons not to. But there's actual a side that's completely economic benefit, because spousal benefits go with a lot of things, a lot of retirement plans, a lot of insurance policies. Yeah, a lot of stuff has that in it. Mm-hmm. Okay, so other interested group, you don't know if you want to join forces. Mm-hmm. Dominique also points out that if you join forces with other interested groups, then you're not duplicating. It prevents duplication. You can just go forward and not repeat, start from the beginning again and repeat what somebody else has done. And you know what I mean. You could just all push forward. Mm-hmm. Shikari says you also exchange ideas and advice. This is true. You exchange your ideas and advice. And that's where the internet is wonderful, and also Skype and conference calls and things, right? Right, yeah. So let's look to the other side. Research about joining with other interested groups. They're researching you too, quite frankly. Mm-hmm. Thinking about you. Research about the opposition. Well, first of all, as Helen says, you want to analyze their reasoning. You want to analyze their reasoning for their opposition. Maybe they've got a point. Mm-hmm. And it needs to be addressed. Because sometimes we see things in a very one-sided, straightforward manner, and we're sure it's right. But maybe they've got a point, too. Just because they're our opposition doesn't mean they're all wrong, right? Yeah. Rob and others are saying that if that's true, and if the opposition has a reasoning, and they've got kind of a viewpoint that's not unreasonable, that we might be able to negotiate to reach an agreement. And then we don't have them as opposition anymore, and quite frankly, they don't have us as opposition anymore, right? We could negotiate with them, and we could reach a common ground. I've done that many times. It looks like we're really not going to get along, and we have real different viewpoints, and we're on both, and we're on opposite sides of the fence, right? But then we find out that both sides have really something going for them. And that we are closer than we think. And that, what, you know how I say to define what success looks like? Well, the definition is pretty similar. We really want the same thing, just from different viewpoints. Hot diggity, we have common ground, right? And we can get together and not spend our time fighting each other about the teeny details, right? You got to look at the big picture. And sometimes that's what's happened. The opposition, the differences between us, because after all, we're somebody's opposition too, are kind of small. And the main issue that we want changed is the same. And we want the same outcome. It's just a question of the path. And we can get together for the common goal. And instead of wasting time and resources fighting, let's put them towards success. Yeah. Mm-hmm. What else do we use opposition research, research about the opposition, for? Shaka says as tactical analysis. Yeah, we've got a lot of agreement about that. Tactical analysis. We're going to look at their weakness, Porter's, right? Well, who it is that's their spokesperson. Good point. A lot of people are talking about funding. Who's funding them? Yeah, we want tactical analysis. We want to know who they are, what they're doing, and who's putting the money behind them. Yeah, because then we can see how we can, well, yeah, I suppose that's true. People are saying how we can win. Well, we want the issues to be resolved in a certain manner. And there might indeed be more than one very strong, very different opinion as to what that manner should be. Change a law, keep it the same, for example. Some sort of social reason, some sort of regulatory reason. Yeah, it's possible that there is kind of a winner. And let's just say someone who fails to get the job done. And, yes, the winner will be us. This is absolutely true. Yeah. So tactical analysis. Nothing wrong with that. They're going to do it on us. They're going to think about who we are and what we've got. And who's behind us. And sometimes the tactical is indeed, as is being pointed out by Shaka and others, kind of a media challenge. Traditional... Excuse me, certainly. But also the non-traditional, what would be the bloggers and the all kinds of people that are, well, working on it. Pardon me. Pardon me. Didn't mean to clear my throat in your ear. Sure, that's a live show. So what's our next topic? That's the gathering of additional information through research. Right? Yeah. And you know, the main thing is for this topic, Joyce and others have hit it on the head, that when you do research, and we're doing the internet, we're talking to people, we are reading things, we are viewing things, we are asking opinions, we're taking surveys, whatever, however we're doing our research, a lot of times, Joyce says, you discover issues that you hadn't considered. Yeah, we discover something that we didn't know. That's why it's research, right? And we go, oh, didn't consider that because didn't know it. Now, it could be any one of the above that we just discussed areas. It could be an opinion, a fact, another group, for or against, any of those things. You find something out that you plain ordinary didn't know. That's why it's research. It's a wonderful thing, right? Yeah. But you find out and you go, oh, that's additional information. We got to bring that to the group. Let's find out all we can about it. Where did it come from? Who is promoting it? Is it a fact or an opinion? All of these things. About the statistics. Let's look at this more closely. Right? Discovery information that you hadn't considered. Issues that you hadn't considered. Colin says that sometimes when you find those extra issues and the additional information that you've researched, sometimes you realize they're unintended consequences. Yeah, unintended consequences. Like prohibition, right? The unintended consequence was the rise of mobsters and people being shot in the streets. I mean, really. And the invention of the repeating weapon. What do they call it, a Tommy gun? The one would put on a whole bunch of bullets? Yeah. There was scientific breakthroughs. See that? Technological ones. But really, sometimes when we research it, we have an idea. We have an idea about how to change something, for example. And when we really go to research it, we find out that maybe we got to rethink exactly what we're doing. Because we find something out that we didn't know, and we think it through logically, and we find out it's got some unintended consequences. Yeah, and Mala says that you might need to modify how you proceed. Yeah, you might have to modify what success looks like. Modify what you're doing. Modify the process to prevent the unintended consequences. Mm-hmm. Unless they're good ones, and then that's a good thing. Yeah, the good unintended consequences. Mm-hmm. I think the next one is we're going to now identify some experts in our research. Right? That's the next one up, to identify experts. We might not know we need experts until we do the research, right? We might think we've got this. We've got the people in line, we've got the whole bit, we've got it. And then we find out the additional information. And we find out about the opposition, about the other groups. We find out about the facts and the statistics. And we go, you know, that's a lot of interesting information. We've sifted it through between us, we've talked about it, we've looked at all sides, we've thought about where the information came from. And now, we need an expert opinion. Yeah, we do. We need an expert opinion on how to proceed. Because we're not so sure, right? Yeah. And so, how are we going to find these experts? Well, Trevor says we're going to discover them through other research. Yeah. And the research might not just be the internet, who's doing what to whom, but might be talking to other people. Calling somebody and said, you know, we've reached an impasse like this, and we need to find someone who can help us. Who do you know? Right? Yeah. If you need something, you need, an opinion about accounting or something, don't you ask around who knows somebody who's really good with this, like forensic accounting, right? Looking at the records or something, you go, you know, that's got a really convoluted paper trail there. We need someone with an expert eye to go look at it, right? Yeah. So you look around with your research to find out who's an expert who can help you, who's quite frankly done it in the past. That's what makes them an expert, right? They've seen it before. They've done it before. They have good reputation. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Kirsten says you have worked the issues in either successfully or unsuccessfully, and that's what makes you an expert, that you've done it, that you've worked with the issues either successfully or unsuccessfully. Mm-hmm. Rasheed makes a good point, too, that the expert may have some specialized knowledge that you need to succeed. Some specialized knowledge. Know something. Know, it has, you know, we've talked about experts before. All these shows are archived on the website, recipeforpeacenow.com. And just having a degree in something certainly doesn't make you an expert. My goodness, it doesn't make you an expert by a mile, especially if it's kind of a new degree. But having done it before does. And you know those other organizations that we talked about? Well, they might, the people who worked with them are your new experts, right? And even if they were unsuccessful, that's okay, because it makes them an expert in what should have been done. And sometimes that's the best expertise of all, right? We didn't quite do it. And we went off on a path that didn't make it. But this is what I would advise you to do. Yeah. Or maybe times have changed, right? Yeah. So now we're going to talk about networking, because that's the best research of all, to each other, to find things out, to know information, and to have everybody impart their wisdom to the group. And one of the ways that Recipe for Peace Now advocates doing this, and also the civility rules of not being rude to each other, is to actually have food in the room and have a potluck, so that when we have a timeout, so that we can take 3 deep breaths and think, or maybe the leader would kind of like to talk to one of us, or a group of us, kind of privately, or we're just plain hungry or tired. And we want everybody to stay in the room so that we can keep connecting, we can keep talking to each other, we can know each other as people and not just as issues sitting around a table. Good to have some food. If you're going to have food, and you are, because it's wonderful and it's fun and it gives you something to talk about that is non-inflammatory, you need to take a survey, though, and ask if anyone has a food allergy, a food prohibition, or a religious prohibition to some sort of food. Also, when people bring the food, you're going to ask them to list what is in it on a little card so that I can run my eye down it as an eater, as a participant, and know if I can eat this, right? Right. Also, I think we should have extra food, because I hate it when the party runs dry. And it makes for a very convivial atmosphere. So I think that the host, which is usually us, should have at least 1 or 2 extra dishes. And I like at least 1 what I call the safe recipe. What makes it a safe recipe? It is something that in my area, I believe my people, my participants, would have eaten before and would know that they could. And I'm telling you is that my safe recipe might not be your safe recipe. This is an international show. But it's something that everybody would have eaten before, know if they can eat it. We've taken our survey. It doesn't violate anybody's food prohibitions, because we want everybody to have a good time. And it doesn't have too many ingredients, right? So that we can all run our eye down the list well. Now, there's an adventure recipe. I think we're going to get to only 1, but the safe recipe, which is Asian noodles with vegetables and chicken, we've been it's been on the list for a little while. So let's do that one now. Let's do it first. I've left a few minutes. I hope I get through it. Oh, I hope so. Okay, so I'm going to say something about this Asian noodle, chicken, and vegetables. The traditional, put something in that you should absolutely, positively never put in. Either fish or oyster sauce, because Asian food tends to do that. People are deathly allergic. Never, ever, ever put in an ingredient that someone might have a possible allergy to, a nut ingredient, a fish ingredient, any kind of an ingredient, even coconut milk, that doesn't show, isn't listed, and no one would dream was in a chicken and vegetable dish. Right? Right. So don't do it, please. Now let's start. We're going to have 2 packages of delicious Asian noodles, like a chow mein or a lo mein or something like that, something yummy that comes dried in the squares and can be picked up. Well, we may or may not use chopsticks, depending on how you feel about that, but that kind of a noodle, an Asian noodle, not a pasta. We're going to have a cup of chicken broth. Oh, let's have a third of a cup of soy sauce. So you have to be careful about soy sauce. I think it'll be fine. We've taken our survey, right? It's salty. It's delicious. I would like to use that hoisin sauce. It comes in a jar. It's kind of like jam almost, a couple tablespoons. If you're not sure about it and you've read the ingredients, then don't use it. You can leave that out. We need a tablespoon of cornstarch. We need to thicken. A tablespoon of oil. Let's have a nice green pepper that we're going to devein and de-seed and slice. Let's chop it, actually. It'll make nicer pieces. Let's chop it. Chop the green pepper. We're going to do the same with the red pepper. If they're kind of smallish, use two of each. I kind of like a yellow one in there, too, just because it looks pretty with the colors. So three peppers, three bell peppers. And let's have about a cup and a half of chopped celery, right? About 4 cups of roasted chicken that I'm going to cube. Did you hear the word roasted, right? Cooked. It has to be, if it's not cooked, you got to cook it. Because I'm not going to tell you how to cook it, but you don't throw anything in raw like that, right? Right. Now, I'm going to say this because this is what I do, but you got to be careful because I'm not that big on leftovers because you have to store them properly, right? If you've been careful and if you've stored it properly, you can use leftover chicken. In the United States, we eat turkey all year long. At least we do in my house. And I usually use cooked, cubed turkey. It's similar to chicken, right? Yeah. It got the same texture and everything. And you make the little cubes. But the key is cooked. And if you're going to use kind of leftovers, make sure that they're still good, that they're fine and dandy to eat leftovers, right? Yeah. So we're going to take those noodles and we're going to cook them and drain them and set them aside, nice and al dente, if that's the word you use for Chinese noodles, right? Yum, yum. Then we're going to take a little bowl. We're going to whisk the broth and the soy sauce and the hoisin sauce. And then we're going to whisk in the cornstarch little by little. Whisk, 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 all combined. We'll put that little bowl aside. And in a large skillet, a wok is cool if you're doing it in front of everybody, but quite frankly, a skillet really doesn't. You heat the oil, and you add the peppers and the celery. Stir fry it, 3 minutes. They've softened slightly. Add the chicken, the cooked noodles, and the broth mixture that you've whisked in a little bowl. Cook, 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 stir, stir, stir. 2 minutes or so. Because everything's really cooked already. The vegetables have been softened. The sauce is cooked. The chicken is cooked. What you're really doing is you're heating them all up together and melding all the delicious tastes, right? And you're going to stir it around in the pot until the sauce is thickened and it's covering the noodles and everything. Everything's kind of combined. Oh, yummy. You serve this with tongs or something so that it can come out of the dish really nicely, right? Yeah. And everyone likes it. It is my safe recipe, assuming that you have taken the survey about allergies and what people can eat. It's also a fun thing to do. You can cook the noodles a little early. They don't take very long either. You can really cook them in the room. If you have the facilities to cook in with the people. I always say that's cooking together with the group. I've been informed that that is not cooking together with the group. That is the not participation, that's the group watching somebody put it together. This is true. But if you prep everything and bring it and you have the facilities, this is fast and it smells good. And you can kind of make it together. It's fun to watch somebody put something together, right? And it's kind of a stir fry. So it's a wonderful thing. I wonder if we have time. Sometimes I blow time and go over, don't I? I think we might have time for the adventure recipe. We've got like 4 minutes. You think I can do it? It's not such a long recipe. This is the adventure recipe for a variety of reasons, primarily because, A, it's fish. A lot of people don't eat fish. They're allergic to it. And it is full of different kinds of spices that might be very familiar to you, to your participants, but not so familiar to my participants. So I have to think about it. And also it's fish. Did I mention fish? Yes. Mm-hmm. It has fish stock and fish and like that. So this is a Moroccan spiced fish. Oh, it's so delicious. It smells wonderful. Mm-hmm. Let's go for it. If I go a little over time, that's okay. We've got 2 tablespoons of olive oil, a nice big sweet onion that we're going to finely chop. I like the big sweet ones. Just a little bit of saffron. First of all, it's terrible expensive, but it a little bit goes a long way. Just a little pinch of saffron threads. Mm-hmm. Let's have a half teaspoon of ground cinnamon. Oh, why not? Let's make a whole teaspoon of ground cinnamon. A whole teaspoon of ground coriander. And a half teaspoon of ground cumin. It's a little bit strong. Go with the cinnamon and the coriander. Mm-hmm. Then we've got a cup of canned diced tomatoes. Yeah, just I don't know if that's a whole can or not drained. Just kind of put them in a cup and drain them a little bit. It doesn't have to be dry. It just don't put all of the juice into it, right? Yeah, cup and a quarter, maybe just a cup of fish stock. You don't have fish stock, you can use vegetable stock. That would be okay, too. Let's have 8 fillets of fish, something firm, because we're going to cut it into chunks so that we can serve it better. Mm-hmm. A snapper, a white fish. Salmon might be a little delicate for this. Something that holds its shape, right? Yeah. And we're going to have a half cup of green olives. I like the kind that, first of all, they have to be pitted no matter what, but I like the kind that are like sliced up, diced, whatever. They're not whole in the jar anymore. They're cut up. They're pieces, I suppose, but it's delicious anyway. And let's have a couple of tablespoons of chopped fresh cilantro. So we're going to take that oil. We're going to heat it in a nice big saucepan. We're going to add the onion. Make it soft. Yeah. Translucent but not brown. Yeah, what does that take, 8 minutes or something? We're going to add the saffron and the cinnamon and the coriander and the cumin. Oh, it's going to smell so good. Circle it around, 30 seconds. I mean, they're spices. They get incorporated right away. Now we're going to add the tomatoes and our fish stock or vegetable stock. And we're going to stir it all up, scrape it all around, bring it to a boil. Mm-hmm. Simmer, reduce the heat, cover, simmer. Yeah. 15 minutes, uncover and simmer another 20. What we're trying to do is we're trying to reduce it down. It's nice and thickish and reduced down. It smells fantabulous, yes. We could do this in the room. Yeah, why not, if we had the room for it. Mm-hmm. We're going to add the fish now. You know you've got some liquid in that pan. So what you do is you kind of poke the fish down with a spatula or something, and push them under the liquid because you want them to get cooked all the way around. If you just let them bob on the top, kind of, it'll cook unevenly. So you want to push them into the delicious, spicy broth. It doesn't take too long. Simmer for, I don't know, about 8 minutes or something until the fish is cooked. Depends how big your pieces are, really. It's all incorporated. You've cooked the fish. It's delicious. It's all hot. You've got those little olives and the chopped cilantro. At the very end, we put them in kind of almost as a garnish. You kind of push the olives and the cilantro into the broth so that they're not really sitting on top. But still, it's almost like a garnish because it's the very end. If you put it in while it's simmering and stuff, they'll just fall apart and just make kind of weird salty green things. So that is the adventure recipe. It's easy to do. It is fast. You could do it in the room also if you felt like it. And it is the adventure because of the fish, right? And of kind of the different kinds of spices. I don't know if people are allergic or can't eat some of those or not, but it's something that you have to inquire about. Yeah, and they don't show, which is the main thing. Hmm? They're kind of a secret in there, so you have to know. So, we're out of time. I knew that would happen. Thank you so much for being here. Thank you for all of your participation. Thank you for listening. Thank you for coming. If you'd like to find us, we're recipeforpeacenow@gmail.com. The website is www.recipeforpeacenow.com. All of the other shows, including this one in about, 5 minutes, are archived on the website, recipeforpeacenow.com. Thank you for coming. Thank you for listening. Thank you for all of your participation. And please do come again. Thanks. Bye-bye.